Why so serious?
All the toys, all the time.
I am the game, and still getting trying to play dude.
You know the rules. This isn't a toy.
But we bought it at the toy store.
We did, but the way I'm using it makes it an adult thing.
Are you ready to play the game?
Yeah! Welcome to the toy department with Matt Kolsky and Derek Madden.
Yeah. All right, here we are. Time for another toy department. How are you feeling this morning, Matt Kolsky?
Fresh. Ready to go.
I am the opposite of fresh right now.
Oh, I'm sorry, bud.
A little Tame Impala show. A little outdoor summertime Tame Impala show last night for me. So
I like a Tame Impala show. They put on a nice little performance.
They do put on a nice little performance. It's weird because, you know, like their music is definitely, you know, you could describe it as psychedelic and trippy, you know, a little bit. Their live show has less improvisation, I feel like, than you might expect from that kind of band. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, yeah. Yes and no. I mean, I see your point. On the other hand, like, they are psychedelic, but they're very specific.
Yeah.
And it's, like, very driving. Like, it's pretty precise for psychedelic music.
Yeah, very specific, I would say, is a good term kind of for what they do live. But you know, now that
they're, it rocks,
it does rock. And now that they're huge, they can definitely afford really good visuals, which I think is important for a band of that type. So, yeah, all in all, a fun experience, but a late and, not entirely sober night for me. So,
yeah, I hear you.
You know, that's how it goes, but I can play Hurt, on the pod today. Cause we, we got some stuff to roll through. Where do you want to start?
Oh man!
I'll put it to you.
Let's do Orange Is the New Black.
All right. How many episodes did you watch of Orange Is the New Black?
I think just two.
Okay.
I think I only watched two.
I think I'm through five. I'm definitely through at least four.
Oh wow!
Yeah.
Let me ask you something. What was there? What if you had to say one thing about your feeling watching the first episode, what would it be?
My feeling watching the first episode. I'd have to put myself exactly in that place, you
right.
know, because now I'm a little bit
I'm
hard
getting
down
at
the
is,
feeling.
I couldn't get over the voiceover.
Yeah, see, now that's not a thing that jumped out at me all. Now I'm trying to remember the voiceover now that you say it. What was your
they
issue?
They did like – it was like – well, it's not – it was like they were doing Mr. Robot all of a sudden or something. it was all this internal monologue stuff.
Who – to just refresh my memory, who was – was it Piper that was doing the voiceover?
It was Piper, and they did some with Alex. I think that's it. I can't remember now for precisely, but I don't know. It was weird. Like Piper was talking us through her trials and tribulations after getting out of prison.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
It was just weird.
I think my impression of that was I found that helpful because I had sort of forgotten that Piper was out there.
Yeah. I mean. I think, look, this is a good show. It remains a good show. I think this is maybe a season more than I needed.
Oh. So, this season takes a bit of a turn, and I don't know if you're at that turn yet.
I'm probably not.
So, yeah, and
so
in
you're
fact,
saying
I think
I don't know what I'm talking about.
I think episode 3 is actually where that happens, just looking at the titles of the episodes.
Yeah, okay.
And
so do we have to come back on this? Do we have to circle back?
So we
on
may
this?
Need to circle back because I do feel like that turn gives the season a particular relevancy. And then have you watched any, like, is there a lot of, I'm trying to remember if any of the tasty stuff is introduced in the first two episodes.
A little bit.
Because I think some of that's interesting, like just sort of her position.
Oh, yeah. Again, this is a good show. The acting remains exceptional. I think the concept, like the conceit of the various plot lines, is interesting. They address a lot of very real issues. But I just, it's not this. I guess what I'm saying is, for two episodes, this doesn't distinguish itself from me from the other seasons.
Well, the one thing
my favorite season of this. Go ahead.
I was gonna say the one thing that really jumps out to me as different about the seasons than the other seasons is that there's a lot less flashback now, and I don't know if that's maybe because we basically know all of the characters, but yeah. we're seeing a lot less of the life before prison stuff, which is you know me, I'm a sucker for flashback stuff that enhances character detail. You know what I mean?
Hell, me too. We talked about it with Euphoria last week, I'm pretty sure. But I don't know. Maybe I just need to get more into it. But to me, it was like, all right, there's more Orange is the New Black, same as the old Orange is the New Black, and that's cool, but not exciting.
Yeah, I think we should revisit this after you watch a couple more.
I'll do that this week. And we'll see if anything else pops. But I don't want to sound like I'm denigrating the show because it's good. It's just it's the same to me. And I guess one way I could sort of make the point is, by far my favorite season of Orange is the New Black was the prison riot, because it was totally fresh.
Mm.
You know what I mean? And it's not like I don't like the show in the prison doing the things it does, but you know what are we, season 8?
Like, this is season 7.
Okay. Yeah. I've seen that 5 times. I've seen what happens in the prison under relatively normal circumstances. So that's all. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, okay. Let's revisit. I'm also excited just because I'm looking at the episode list now, and Natasha Lyonne directs an episode this season. And
excellent.
You know, seeing that post.
Odd favorite, Natasha Lyonne.
Yeah. Post her last series, that sounds exciting to me. Also, Laura Prepon, although I guess she's directed a few in the past, which had not realized. I didn't realize that was in her little bag of tricks. That 70 Show alums, man, still out there doing it, you know?
Is that the greatest movie success story for a sitcom cast ever? I mean, Topher Grace still gets great parts and really is an interesting character actor. Mila Kunis is a huge star.
Yeah.
Laura Prepon is on one of the biggest television shows on, available. And
I mean, Kutcher's had a pretty big career.
Huge career. Huge. The only guy who didn't make it really big is Fez.
Yeah, who, like, you know, I think Fez had a respectable Hollywood life.
Yeah, and he definitely is like he's like an interesting Hollywood character.
Yeah, I mean, I think you got to look at the Friends cast.
But I don't know.
In that conversation.
I mean, LeBlanc and Matt Matthew Perry have both, even Schwimmer. Like, I would argue that the only person on Friends who had a bigger career than those four from that 70s show is Jennifer Aniston.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I think Courtney Cox certainly did some, especially early on, at some good movie roles, and then a good sitcom.
This is not about dissing Courtney Cox. I'm just saying, Topher Grace, Mila Kunis, Laura Prepon, and Ashton Kutcher, I would say, have all had at least as much success as Courtney Cox. Right?
Yeah, maybe two more at you. The Office, right? I mean, you got to start with Carell.
Yeah, Krasinski and
Krasinski are like, you got two movie stars at the top. I mean, obviously it's a bigger cast, right? So you got a lot of people. But Mindy Kaling's had a pretty big career.
That's true. That's a good one.
That's in the mix. And then I think you got to sort of think about Parks and Rec. I mean, Chris Pratt turned into like an A-list movie star. And Aubrey Plaza's had a pretty good movie career.
Right. Those two are really good. The 30 Rock that's a little different because 30 Rock, a lot of those people had careers already.
Right.
I think How I Met Your Mother isn't bad either, because Allison Hannigan and Well, obviously Neil Patrick Harris has his own thing, but Allison Hannigan and what's his face, Jason Segel, are both quite big.
Yeah, although Jason sort of got big as the show was still on when he was doing movies. You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Speaking of that world, can we transition from that to Seth Rogen, who's a producer on The Boys?
Yeah, that's a nice nice transition.
How
about you?
How about that? Yeah, we came into this. I'm going, all right, it's a superhero show, and it definitely is a superhero show. But
not
I was
like any superhero show you've seen, though.
That's correct, and I was pretty into this, which I feel like is for me is about as high praise as I can give a show like this that involving superpowers. Like, I think
I feel like that's a big win for me personally.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting story. It's an interesting idea. I will probably watch the rest of them.
And this is like for all the content related to powers that we get. I think creating a powers-based show that feels totally unique and original is a hell of an accomplishment.
Yeah, I would agree. I would also say that this show could work without superheroes. You know what I mean? Like, if this was just kind of a spy show about private defense contractors that took place in the real world,
really,
that it would have been just as effective. But using the superhero template does not take anything away from it at all. In fact, it adds some layers at times.
And I think you make an interesting point, because I think it's flipped. It's not using the superhero template, and that's what's kind of cool. It's using, like, the noir spy, bad acting military contractors template. And it grafts the superhero stuff into it, and I think it's really effective.
Yeah,
because
me too.
The name superheroes in the show are the antagonists.
Yeah.
How often do we have superhero antagonists without superhero protagonists?
Yeah,
it never happens.
I mean, clearly they're setting up. I mean. They're setting up one of the superheroes to flip to the protagonist side, right? Yeah, yeah.
They're going to need some powers on their side, ultimately. Yeah. But still, like, it's the construction of, like, good spy in the bad organization teaming up with outsiders to bring down the evil spies, right?
Yeah.
Except instead of spies, they're superheroes.
I don't know if you've been watching any more of The Shield, but it does sort of – it almost reminds me of that in some ways. Like, the superheroes almost remind me of, like, the cops in The Shield.
The bad cops.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's a great – that's a great comparison. And I think that is – we have not really seen that with superheroes. We've seen some very light exploration of, you know, like the Civil War controversy, the superheroes are destroying things by accident. It's a huge problem. They're run amok. But the, like, conglomerate of superhero evil that the people – I mean, there's a lot here thematically, and it is really well done.
I mean, if you think about it, if you have just certain people who live on Earth – and I guess X-Men gets into some of this territory a little bit – but, like, that if you had certain people who lived on Earth that were more powerful than the rest of people and kind of used those powers to fight crime and got really famous and rich because of that, you could definitely see how there would be some temptation for those people to be corrupted by that and to still be doing acts of good, but to also be kind of just really selfish, crappy people, right? And so it's like... like the way that this show paints them, I think is you know, in terms of, I know we're talking about people with superpowers, but it's very plausible to me.
Yes, and it's a pretty, like, that part of it is this age old idea of power run amok, right? And we see that all the time in spy movies and business based movies of, like, the giant corporation that's, you know, too powerful for everyone's good. And it's seeing it where they actually have powers. It is, I don't know, maybe it doesn't sound as fresh when I say it out loud, but it feels new.
Yeah, it does. And it's and I think it's pretty damn hard to do a superhero show that feels new at this
yes.
point.
Yes, so. Yeah, exactly. That's exactly my point.
So, yeah, so I'm in on this. Can I also just shout out, it made me super happy that there was one point where a character is complaining about all this the suits that work in the corporation. Yeah. he's like a bunch of suits up there with their Cornell degrees.
Right. And it's like the 82nd floor or something.
Yeah,
the 82nd floor. Like the nerds up in the.
And I was like, yes.
Yeah.
Shout out. I also want to say I think Elizabeth Shue is really great as the.
She's excellent.
And I'm just happy to see her doing
Elizabeth
stuff.
Shue.
Yeah. Like you're never not happy to see Elizabeth Shue pop up on your screen. Like it's pretty infrequent these days. It feels like, but
yes, way too infrequent. Semi-related point. One of the great absurdist '90s action flicks, The Saint, starring Elizabeth Shue.
Oh yeah,
Strong recommend from me.
That, I gotta say, that's one that I have not visited in quite some time.
It is so silly. It is such a wonderful '90s action movie with the ridiculous love story and the absurd, like, surviving crazy stunt nonsense. It's just, it's elite.
Awesome. All right, are you ready to talk about Shangri-La?
I sure am.
This is a thing we've been watching, I guess, for a couple weeks. I think we had it on the homework list a few weeks ago. It's a documentary on Showtime about the life of Rick Rubin. And I found it, you know, as a music lover and someone, you know, in the music business to be fascinating.
I thought it was incredible. And let me ask you this. What do you feel like the goal was?
The goal of the show?
Yeah.
I think, honestly, that's an interesting question. I think the show understands that it is, you know, glorifying the subject. It's a bit, I believe, hagiography is the right word for that, of the subject.
Uh-huh.
But I feel like that's sort of a, it's almost like a side benefit that the show the show is really about mentorship and what it takes to facilitate people making great art.
Yeah, and what it takes to facilitate people becoming their best selves.
Yeah.
And I think when I asked the question, what I had in mind was much more so than telling a specific story. This thing to me seemed to be trying to create a mood and almost trying to create the mood you might feel hanging out at Shangri-La Studios doing your art with Rick Rubin.
I think it does that very well too, actually.
I think it does it incredibly well. It makes you feel like I'm just watching this guy help other people, and it makes me feel like I'm ready to live my best creative life.
Yeah.
Because I'm watching it, and there's real wisdom, man. This guy, he's more guru than music producer.
Yeah, like typically you watch a Behind the Music or something like that, and they talk about a producer, and you see him inside, that guy who's like, you know, yelling at people and taking 45 minutes to mic the drum just so, to get that sound. And there's a lot of great records that are made that way. I'm not trying to denigrate that way.
And there's a lot of stuff done. There's a lot of stuff done at Shangri-La to make those same concessions, but it doesn't seem to be the point.
No, it's not really the point at all. And like, so much of the advice he gives is really simple, but also kind of profound. And it does, and it generally helps you sort of look at a song in a new way. And when I think the artist interviews in this are all pretty instructive, because they are, you know, they almost sort of talk about really how he makes you feel, or how the space makes you feel, or the place that they get in to sort of create. And you kind of, you really understand where they're coming from when they say it.
Yep. And nothing in this movie is about anything he did musically.
Yep.
I mean, really, none of the, like, those artists interviews you mentioned, no one's like, oh man, the drums on 99 Problems. That doesn't happen. No one's like, you know, I had this song and like Rick added a note to the bass line and boom, all of a sudden it hit. None of it is that. It's all he helped me reach an understanding. He helped me figure out myself. He helped me get in the right headspace for this.
Yep. There's also a lot of talk about the physical space of the site. I mean, that's, I feel like, a big part of it. You know, the history of Shangri-La, and then the various rooms that they used to record in, and what those things are for. That, and I think all of that is really illuminating, because it all does seem to have a design that's sort of built towards his general philosophy about creation. You know.
Yes, and I just think there's a lot to take here for anybody about life. Like, this is just he is truly. There's another sort of fascinating thing about it to me, that watching what he does, and I think this is probably a relatively common experience to music lovers who would watch this, you start to feel like, on one hand, I could be Rick Rubin, and on the other hand, I could never be Rick Rubin, and I really need a Rick Rubin in my life.
Yeah, I definitely because took a little more of the latter.
Well, because he says things like, you know, I don't have any special expertise. Like, my whole career is just being a really practiced, attentive fan. And it's true. He's not – his genius is not a musical genius, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
It's a level of artistic genius, and it's – and certainly it's impactful. But he's not a musician. Never has. He's, as the point is made repeatedly, he's more a pro wrestler than a musician.
Yeah, I mean, you shouldn't say never. He was in a band,
of course,
when he started.
But
yeah.
But I was in a band. You know what I mean?
Yeah, right. Like,
so I'm not. Look, I'm sure he can play instruments, and he obviously has an incredible wealth of knowledge on the way production. I'm not dissing the guy's musical acumen. I'm just saying that's not his genius.
Right.
His genius is an emotional, spiritual genius. And when he says things like, you know, this is an incredible line. I believe in everything, at least until it's proven wrong. And even then, I still believe it's possible, basically, was his sort of philosophy on life. And it's just like there's a lot more there than it sounds like, you know. Yeah. That's not just like, oh, whatever's clever, I'm into it. No, like. He's saying he is expressing a genuine feeling of being in touch with the world around him and aware of, I don't know, I don't think there's a better way to say it. His genius is being in touch with the world.
Yeah.
And understanding. It's a Steve Jobsian genius.
Yeah.
I know what you want even when you don't know what you want.
And I think it's the kind of thing, to that point, that if for me, as someone who manages creative people for a living, I feel like there's a lot you can just sort of take from it, his philosophy and way of working with people, and really seeing his role as managing creative people as mostly just an enabler, like, you know, just sort of enabling people to be their best selves. And by the way,
it's what every good coach, every good leader, every good boss in the world does. It's putting people in position to succeed.
Yeah.
We say it all the time, and I don't think we think it through. But that's really what he's doing, is putting all these disparate artists with different skills and different talents in the position to succeed on an individual basis.
Yeah. I think that, it's also really fascinating, and this is just the way that he works. This is just him. I don't even know if it's not a great stroke of genius by the show, but it is fascinating to watch this man work in bare feet and mostly lying down, which is just not a thing that you see.
Sitting, right, or sitting cross-legged with his eyes closed, just like bobbing his head.
Yeah.
And I'm sure, look, this is not the comprehensive Rick Rubin producing manual. Like, he's obviously more hands-on at times. But almost everything we see in the show is him being like, yeah, that's great. Great job.
Yeah.
And there's something to that. That is clearly deliberate. if they wanted to cut a bunch of stuff of him being like, what if we turn up the bass noise here? They could have. He obviously does that. But I think the point the film tries to make is, yeah, he does that stuff, but there's tons of people who could do that stuff. There's only one Rick Rubin because of the other stuff, because he's a coach and a mentor and a guru.
Yeah, kind of all rolled into one. The performances, I shouldn't say performances, because it's mostly people just, they're just showing people recording. But the footage of the artist recording is some of it's really great. In particular, I thought
the Mac Miller stuff is just heartbreaking.
Yeah. And then I thought the Kate Tempest stuff where she, I don't know if you got it, where she was recording outside. Like some of that stuff
is the whole
album. Yeah, is really electric to watch her kind of do that, and just the energy in that space. Which you could tell is why they wanted to do it. So,
and you can also tell that's just it's the perfect illustration of the space that Rick Rubin creates for artists to be their most creative selves. Like, this is a weird idea, and she even says it like, we don't know if this is really going to work. But the idea was, let's record the whole album all at once in different spots and see what the result is, and then put together the best version. And, like, believe me, that's not happening to a band who rents a recording studio in downtown LA. It's just you don't get to do that.
Yeah. You know, and if you watch, like, Sound City or anything like that, like, you know, sometimes those other spaces are great. You know what I mean? Or magical in their own way. But this is just it's just a whole different thing. I'm glad that we got to peek at it.
I also just like this as sort of a living document about that magic.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I think you and I are in a similar position on this, that, like, we're not big, real-world magic guys in terms of, you know, the spirituality and the sort of stuff. I think we have our own views of it, but we're not tracking daily miracles, but I think we both believe in the sort of magic of a space like that.
Yep.
It just can't be a coincidence that The Last Waltz was filmed here, and years later it becomes one of the most prolific recording studios and this place with this thing that it has. And that thing might just be the collected joy or appreciation of the people who arrive. But it's real.
Yeah. By the way, while we're here, if anyone knows where The Last Waltz might be streaming, because I've been having trouble finding it somewhere, I would kind of like to just watch that. So if there's anybody listening who knows that.
I happen to own it. I think my parents owned it before me, but it's great. It's great.
Yeah.
The band is fascinating, man. The band is probably – it's certainly on the Mount Rushmore of, like, underappreciated historical music.
Yeah, and I haven't seen it all the way through. So, I know it's like, just as a movie, it's one of the great rock movies of all time. So I would like to watch it, and I've really enjoyed the clips from it in this. I'm curious, did you like the use of the flashbacks to, like, the bearded – flashback's the wrong word, I guess, use of the beard, young bearded Rick Rubin.
And Samoan wrestler Rick Rubin. Yeah. Like, I thought it was a really effective, because again, a lot of this is just like, it's almost like the holy book of the Rick Rubin, guru thing, right? And so, like, like you said, there's some hagiography aspects. Like, Rick Rubin's a producer, and most episodes, I think all four of them, if not maybe three of them, start with a Rick Rubin quote about, like, life. And as much as I appreciate Rick Rubin's insights on life, he's not exactly Confucius. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, it's like when they put up these deep quotes and then it's like Rick Rubin, you're like, oh, okay. But also they're deep things. He says deep shit, man.
Yeah.
So, like, I don't know, how does someone become, like, a noted spiritual guru to the world other than just being deep as hell and really on top of stuff? So I just thought all that sort of what's the right word for it? Not quite psychedelic, but, like, conceptual flashback art, I guess you could call it, was I thought really effective.
Yeah. I once got an invite to Shangri-La, but it was one of those sort of like open ended, like you should come out sometime, like, you know. And,
from who invited you?
Well, Rick did, but I think also, you know, like one of the labels that he was working with, they were like, you should come out. But it was not like it was one of those like, you should come out next week. It was sort of one of those open ended, like, you know, hey, sometime you should come out. And I left LA before
and
he has to do it.
And I'm returning here.
And like, yeah, now I'm really sad.
At a certain point.
So
you could go.
And I say Rick, like, I talked to him all the time. I met him once and we had a conversation.
You could still go.
But I really feel like I wish that a conversation had come after I'd seen this, because I feel like it would have gone very differently. But
oh, well. Oh, yeah? What are you guys doing tomorrow?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, I should come out? Cool. I'm free from now for the next year or so.
Yeah. But, you know, when you live in LA, it's also like, oh, it's in Malibu, and I live here, and it's going to take you know what I mean? Right? Like,
so funny.
You have to do
that. Because that was ultimately the inspiration for the creation of this studio, is Rivers Cuomo being like, I can't drive back and forth from LA to Malibu. What am I, crazy?
That's a real thing, by the way.
I'm not driving from the beach to Los Angeles on a daily basis. Get out of here.
Yeah, like, that's a day trip. You know what I mean? you know, when you make that decision to cross the 405 in that town, you're making a real decision. It's a commitment. all right. Let's move on to Chance the Rapper, who I don't think has worked with Rick Rubin, to my knowledge.
No, I think he does. I think he has, actually.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
It's not on his Wikipedia discography. So
Chance or Rubin?
Rubin. Chance, maybe.
Didn't Chance make an appearance?
I think you're right. I think maybe he did, actually. Maybe this discography is incomplete.
Rick Rubin produced some of the stuff on 3. Or at least they recorded some stuff there. And also, I think he worked the Kanye album.
He definitely worked the Kanye album, yeah.
Which I think was at Shangri-La.
Oh, okay. Fair enough. By the way, side note, since I was on Rick Rubin's Wikipedia page, I also didn't realize that he's in My Guest Needs No Introduction. I guess I need to go watch that now, too.
Rick Rubin is.
Yeah,
I didn't know that either. Yeah, I'd like to watch that.
So. But yeah, anyway, on a chance. I really enjoyed this new record. How'd you feel about it?
I did too. What's your favorite song?
Oh, that's a good question, actually.
So is that the problem? That's my point.
Yeah.
Is that the problem? Because you know what I kept thinking? It's a 22-track album. And we got a handful of 22-track albums, I want to say, like, last winter.
Yeah, 22 included some skits, we should say.
Yeah, but the Travis Scott album, the Nicki Minaj album, and I think our reaction to those was pretty similar in that, like, we pretty much liked those albums, but there was just too much, and it felt like they could have trimmed the fat. And what's interesting about this Chance album is it's too long, but I can't necessarily tell you which songs absolutely need to stay and which songs could go, because they're all pretty good.
Yeah, it's...
I don't know if any of them are great, but it's all pretty good.
I would agree with you that there are too many songs. You know what I mean?
Right.
But it's weird, because I feel like there are too many songs, but it doesn't feel all that... Like, it sort of takes a long time to listen to, but it's a breezy, jaunty sort of consistent record. You know what
and
I mean?
That's why I say consistent is the perfect word. And that's why I say I feel like when we listen to Nicki and Travis Scott, and I'm not picking on them. That's just the ones I remember that happened to be in the 20s of tracks and went on too long. I feel like we were listening to those and pretty quickly could identify, you know, if this is an album I listen to repeatedly, I'm skipping these 6 tracks, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this Chance, like, that's why I say I don't know what you do other than just slow the hell down and save some for the next album. But I don't necessarily want a guy to do that if he's getting out all his creative stuff. Like, give me what you got. But I don't know. I don't know. Maybe this is like a just an expression of my own failing attention span. But I did like I would give this album a B plus, and I would give almost every song on it a B plus.
Yeah.
And I don't know what I would do to make it an A.
As I'm looking at track listings, I really the first two tracks kind of jump out to me. I really loved kind of coming out, you know, with that first track that's sort of like, you know, we're not here to please everybody, and we know who we are, which I think is a really good statement for kind of the criticism that sometimes surrounds Chance.
Yes.
I would say tracks that sort of jump out to me besides those two would be Ball and Flossin'.
That was great. You know, I think the best moments are all the really throwback moments.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. There's some real, like, early 90s feeling tracks on here, and I think Chance sounds great on that sort of spare beat, rapping a little faster and more rhythmically than he often does. I like seeing that side of him. So I'm not saying there's nothing, you know, nothing's better than anything else, but I do think it's all quite good, and maybe nothing jumps out in the same way that a couple, you know, like you listen to Acid Rap and Cocoa Butter Kisses just screams at you, right?
Yeah.
You listen to Three, and before it became a huge radio sensation, no problems. It's clearly a star, superstar hit, right? And this album doesn't have one of those.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. Yeah, it definitely doesn't. I don't know that there's that big single. But man, there are some really great features on this record. Inspired,
and, yeah,
I would almost
look,
say.
Everything about it's good.
SWV and in Vogue. Randy Newman is a feature.
I'm sounding down on it because it was great. Randy. I mean, come on.
Nicki Minaj drops a couple great verses.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, like Shawn Mendes, I think, is an interesting idea too. I don't know. I'm gonna listen to this record more than once, but I don't know.
I've already listened to it five times.
Oh yeah, yeah. Sorry, I listened to it more than once in preparation for this. I'm gonna continue to come back to this. But you're right. It's hard for me to say, like, here's the standout jam that's gonna be on my best of, you know, 2019 mixtape in the end of the year. You know what I mean?
Right. You know what else, though? I'm, and I guess this is pretty, it's Chance. It's his brand. But, like, this is a positive album about love and hoping things can be better, you know? And that's nice.
Yeah.
Am I oversimplifying it? Like, it's a lot of stuff, but it's all pretty. There's a lot about his wife and his kid, and he seems like a good dude in a good spot.
It's interesting. I was having a conversation with Stephen Hyden, like an offline conversation yesterday, about how there's just not much danger anywhere in music right now in terms of, like, you know, like, even the rap game is pretty, like, positive and happy in general. Like, who's the scary guy in hip hop right now? Like, there's some people who in their personal lives have maybe done some criminal things.
They're bad dudes.
Yeah.
Right.
But their music, nobody's music is particularly angry right now in any genre. So I do feel like we're sort of in this positive era of hip hop right now, but his is almost the most sort of radiant, joyous example of that. Now there's a little more God stuff than my personal taste would allow, but, you know, not everything's made to my personal taste.
Too. No, and it feels joyous is a good word, and in not naive but innocent way. You know, there's like a innocent exuberance to what he does. It's almost like it. I don't know any better. We're just here having fun and being positive.
Yeah. You know? And there was a time when it was like, if you said positive rap, you thought of things like Will Smith, you know what I mean?
It was a knock.
Yeah. And no, you know, no shot to Will Smith. He had a couple jams, a couple, but this is so much more next level than that. Like, these are real good quality records, you know what I mean?
Right. Right. And I think, you know, Chance gets attacked for being cheesy, but I actually think what sets him apart from Big Willie Style is that he manages to be sincere and innocent without being cheesy.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it's like, I think he's just being him. I think it's authentic.
That's it. It didn't feel authentic from Will Smith. It felt like, what can I say and do to make the biggest pop rap record of all time?
Yeah.
And he did.
Yeah,
but,
sure did.
But this feels like just a positive, joyous person expressing their truest self, and it's cool.
Agreed. Agreed.
We should all be such a positive person.
Yep. The world would use more chances, frankly. And that was not a pun in any sense of the word.
Yeah. It was pretty good. It may not have been intended, but it worked for me.
All right. Do you got anything else to add, or should we go to homework?
Man, is that it? Did we do everything?
That is all the things. We got a lot of homework, though.
All right. Let's get to it.
You know, I say that now, and then we're going to get off the podcast. I'm going to be like, we forgot a thing.
I know.
Which feels like happens every week now, which means I probably should get better writing stuff down. But I did write down all of our homework.
We did do the customary pre-show meeting where we went through everything, and then you went, okay, but I didn't write any of that down.
Yeah, so correct.
We're out here.
We're on our normal schedule. Yeah. All right, so we did have one screw-up from this week, and I have decided it is not my fault. It's Rotten Tomatoes' fault.
Well, you didn't just decide. You sourced the data and proved that it was not your fault.
Yes. They told us the Bachelor in Paradise premiere was Monday, and if you're in Bachelor World, you know how wrong that is already, and if not, it was wrong. They're still doing Bachelorette. It wrapped up last night. Paradise starts Monday, so we will watch one episode of that. Although,
thank God there's no break between the two.
Exactly.
If only The Challenge could produce as much content as friggin' The Bachelor.
The Challenge does occasionally jump from one season right to the next, and I wish it was like that all the time. With like they should have like
where's my next season, Eric?
Yeah.
Where is my next season of The Challenge? Because right now I have no challenge.
It should be like soccer. There's like a 2-3 month off season, and then other than that, it's just going all the time.
We even know what the next. Oh wait, here we go. The Challenge 34, Bloody Hell, will be U.S. versus the U.K.
Oh, excellent! Excellent.
At least at first. It filmed in May and June in Thailand, and
excellent.
It doesn't say.
Doesn't say when it's going to be.
Doesn't say when it comes.
I'm so fired up for that. Half a season of Brits. Brits versus USA is going to be – that'll be tremendous.
In Thailand. That'll be great.
Yeah. All right. I'm about it.
See, it should be on already.
Yeah.
Stop wasting my time, Challenge.
Bachelor in Paradise will not be as good as the Challenge, but
I'll enjoy it.
I do expect, at least relative to the rest of the Bachelor Road, that you might enjoy it a little bit. So we shall see. We shall see. Dear White People's coming back. Also fired up for that. That drops Friday on Netflix, so we'll talk a little bit about that.
Do we love this show more than anyone else? I mean, I guess not, because it keeps coming back. But I love this show.
Yeah,
I don't see anyone talking about it besides us.
It is hard to say, with Netflix, they're so weird about telling you how many people watch things.
Yeah.
But I do think it's telling. You know, we're grabbing this off a Rotten Tomatoes page. These premiere dates, and they're. It is not a tomato meter by Dear White People, which means that not that many people are even reviewing it, although it may not be available to critics yet. And maybe that's part of it. We'll see.
All right.
But Glow has reviews, and Glow's not out for like another week. So,
Yeah, that's weird.
Yeah. So, I don't know if it's a show that's in the zeitgeist, and I feel like that's a shame because I think it's really well done.
Yeah, I mean, if we wanted to edge into the non-toy department, it's an even bigger shame, frankly.
Yeah, agreed.
A lot of people could learn some things.
But again, the fact that they keep making more of them at least suggests that some people are watching it.
Yeah, good sign.
Because we've certainly seen Netflix pull the plug on things that would be surprising sometimes. So, all right, Hard Knocks returns. This year is the Oakland Raiders. I mean, this does seem like the absolute perfect time to feature the Oakland Raiders on Hard Knocks, wasn't it?
Autumn Wind is a Raider.
I expect between you know, the Gruden stuff and Antonio Brown arriving in town, like, this is just going to be a bad shit season. Yes,
in a hot air balloon. I like the battle for screen time between Antonio Brown and John Gruden is like, it's a real world battle of the bastards. It is an epic showdown. I am so excited.
Yeah, no, I'm excited for that. Also, the
seriously, hold on, just stop for 1 second. Who in the entire sports world is more attention whorey than Antonio Brown and John? Okay, there are. It's like when you talk about the hottest people in the world. You know, like, you can give me people who might be as hot as Beyonce, but not hotter.
Yeah, it's true.
You can find people who might be equally interested in camera time to John Gruden and Antonio Brown, but not more interested.
Yeah. No, that is as thirsty a couple as you'll find. And yes, it doesn't end there. There are a couple more things that I'm just pouring over the Raiders depth chart right now.
And you're seeing, like, players from the national championship game, because that was the only thing John Gruden watched.
there's some of that. So, look, I think, like, Hunter Renfrow from Clemson trying to make this team could be a really...
Oh, he's going to be such a darling. Yeah. Dude, the fantasy bump on Hunter Renfrow from Hard Knocks
is going to be real. I just, you know, there is a position battle for backup quarterback between Mike Glennon and Nathan Peterman, which to me has unintentional comedy potential that is just off the charts. Like, Gruden trying to decide between those two and just pumping them up is going to be fantastic.
He has already held a press conference to say how much he loves Nathan Peterman.
Yeah. I can't wait.
It's like, you can just – the great thing about Hard Knocks with a team like the Raiders, especially being somewhat close to what's going on there, is – I get to watch the real life as like a preview of Hard Knocks. So when John Gruden comes out and extols the virtues of Nathan Peterman, I know we're going to have scenes of him watching Peterman video and saying to his fellow coaches, "Hey man, you know, this guy, I tell you, he's got something."
Yeah, look at this guy. This guy's a guy. We got him.
I can't wait. It's going to be amazing.
Middle linebacker Vontaze Burfict.
Oh God! It just keeps getting better.
Like, it just keeps on giving. I think Brandon Marshall will be interesting. Interesting Hard Knocks player. Doug Martin, the muscle hamster, is on this team now.
He was there last year too. Just you weren't watching.
Yeah, that's correct. Also correct. So yeah, I think a lot of potential for this season of Hard Knocks. I haven't been in on every Hard Knocks, but I'm definitely in on the Raiders for 2019.
Yes.
All right. Another homework item that I'm kind of fired up about. If you've seen the trailer on HBO and all, Black Lady Sketch Show premieres on Friday. That is an Issa Rae production with just like a boatload of funny black ladies that you've seen elsewhere doing stuff.
Excellent.
So I'm slow on the Wikipedia draw here, but I was going to try to see if I could actually get the lineup of people who are involved just from the from the clips.
Yeah, you are slow.
Sorry, I'm typing and talking at the same time. Okay. The main cast is Issa Rae, Ashley Nicole Black, who if you watched Sam B's show, she was kind of her head writer. And then some people I'm not familiar with: Robin Thede, Gabriel Dennis, and Quinta Brunston. And then there are just a crap load of guest stars who are not listed.
Robin
Thede, Thede.
Oh, and I think it's Thede. Yeah.
Thede?
Yeah. I think it's Thede. Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
She was a, I believe I heard her on Larry Wilmore's podcast.
I'm going to guess a lot of people in the show have been on Larry Wilmore's podcast.
And I think she was a writer for his for the nightly show.
Gotcha.
Among other things. Yeah, 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 yeah.
The episode on Friday is called Angela Bassett is the Baddest Bitch. I have a feeling that she probably will show up.
I agree.
That, yeah. Oh. Also,
was
I
that,
agree.
I thought that was just that was the name of the show, not a statement. Okay.
Yeah, so there you go. All right, so that's coming, and then Whitney Cummings has a comedy special on Netflix, and so we'll
a
probably
Whitney
watch.
Cummings comedy special is coming.
Yes, the Cummings is coming. Actually, I think it's already here. I think it came out.
Comedy Cummings is coming.
I think it came out yesterday. It's called "Can I Touch It?" is the name of the special.
Ooh, there you go. I like Whitney, so I'm excited. Yeah. That's all I got. All
right, so that is a big list of stuff. I'm actually going to try to watch all of it for.
Oh, good. I appreciate that. Oh, and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Oh, right. Yes, that put that on the homework as well. That I have already seen. And Kolsky now
we're all very proud of you, Derek. But some of us have other things to do. Okay, some of us don't get to see the early show. We got to wait until a Sunday morning when the grandparents are in town to watch the baby. All
thank
right?
you,
some
grandparents, because I actually do have a number of thoughts on that one, and I wouldn't mind getting them out. So
I'm excited. I'm very excited to see this. I've been listening to Quentin Tarantino podcast content, and it's go time as far as I'm concerned.
Go time indeed, and I think also go time for us.
Okay, bye.
This game's in the Admiral refrigerator. The door is closed. The light's out. Butter's getting hard, the eggs are cooling, and the Jell-O is jiggling.
So long, everybody.
And do me a favor, have yourself a tremendous evening.